morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN condemns sexual assault on peaceful protesters in Sudan.
We've also received allegations of sexual harassment by security forces against women who were trying to flee the area around the presidential palace on Sunday evening. It is crucial that security forces guarantee and protect the right to peaceful assembly.
Rescue operations were continuing late Tuesday for survivors and victims of a boat accident off the coast of Madagascar. The UN says over 800,000 people are affected by flooding in South Sudan. Residents of eastern Congo protest alleged Rwandan police presence in their country. And Ghana MPs exchange blows over proposed electronic payment tax.
I've said this since the beginning of the year, that if we are not careful, this is how, if Parliament is going to be characterized by a lot of confusion, a lot of gridlock.
And Zimbabwe's anti-corruption board says it is hampered by the lack of protection for whistleblowers. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN human rights officials are calling on Sudanese authorities to bring to justice those members of the security forces found guilty of sexually assaulting several women and girls during demonstrations held Sunday in the capital Khartoum. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
What began as a peaceful protest quickly turned into a chaotic scene of sexual violence, harassment, and deadly force. UN Human Rights Spokeswoman Liz Throssell says UN monitors in Sudan have received reports 13 women and girls were victims of rape or gang rape during a recent demonstration.
We've also received allegations of sexual harassment by security forces against women who were trying to flee the area around the presidential palace on Sunday evening. Two protesters died after being shot and around 300 others were injured, some due to the use of live ammunition, some hit by tear gas canisters or beaten by security forces, and others who suffered breathing difficulties from tear gas inhalation.
Tens of thousands of people took part in demonstrations marking the third anniversary of protests that led to the overthrow of the government of President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. Demonstrators also gathered to protest the military coup in October and the political agreement that was signed in November. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Sudanese authorities to investigate the allegations of rape and sexual harassment promptly and thoroughly. Throssell says the alleged deaths and injury of protesters because of the disproportionate use of force and live ammunitions also must be investigated.
The perpetrators must be identified and prosecuted. With further protests planned for this weekend and the weeks ahead, it is crucial that security forces guarantee and protect the right to peaceful assembly and act with full respect for international laws and standards regulating the use of force.
Throssell notes the country's acting attorney general has set up a committee of senior prosecutors to investigate all human rights violations committed since the military coup on October 25th. The UN Human Rights Office is urging national authorities to make the committee findings public and to hold to account those responsible for human rights violations and abuses. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Flooding in South Sudan has affected more than 800,000 people since May. Thousands more have been displaced as access to health facilities, water, schools, and more is impacted. Arafat Jamal, the UNHCR country representative in South Sudan, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the ongoing crisis.
So South Sudan is truly a country on the front lines of the climate emergency today. It's no stranger to floods. In fact, many South Sudanese will say that they are mentioned in the Book of Isaiah and the Bible as the nation whose lands the rivers have spoiled, and they think that that refers actually to South Sudan, which it might. Which is to say that flooding is a natural occurrence here. But what's not natural is the frequency, the intensity, and the geographical scope of the flooding this year. People remember a massive flood of 1962. What we're seeing right now is 3 years of 1962 level flooding. It has completely eroded people's ability to survive. When you have flooding in 1 year, population, which consists of both pastoralists and sedentary farmers, they have means of coping. But these mechanisms can only serve you for so long. And what it's done is it wipes out 1 year of crops, it wipes out a second year, and then by the time you get to the third year, people have already lost their livelihoods.
What kind of pressure does this put on an already strained population in terms of resources?
Yeah, South Sudan is the world's newest nation, and it is it's doing a valiant effort to build itself up as a nation, but it is very, very weak. So on top of chronic underdevelopment, the floods have really wiped out any gains that may have existed, and they've wiped them out in terms of infrastructure and shelter, which have gone under the water, but they've also wiped out the agricultural produce, and they have drowned whole flocks of cows. And this is a country with a population of 12 million, but some 16 million heads of livestock. The government has allocated, for example, this year $10 million to respond to the floods. That's a drop in the bucket, but it is significant that it is trying its best to respond. But it is also a country that is massively dependent upon the international community to help. And the humanitarians spend about $1 billion a year in South Sudan on relief efforts, and we continue to do that with the floods as well.
What kind of long-term solutions are being looked at?
Our first response has been to provide relief. It's to save lives and alleviate sufferings. Indeed, what this country needs is really a combination of climate adaptation policies and longer-term development. And one of the things that the system has done in general is to build dikes. For example, in a place called Jonglei State, the government has taken its own effort to build a 5-meter-high, 20-meter-across, and 80-kilometer eventually long dike that is holding back the waters.
That was Arafat Jamal, UNHCR country representative in South Sudan. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Juba. Lawmakers in Ghana exchanged blows late Monday evening over a proposed electronic payment tax. The government says the new tax would boost revenue for development, but parliament has been split over the idea, and fights broke out when supporters tried to force a vote. Kent Mensah reports from Accra, Ghana.
Ghanaians in general, and the opposition in particular, have vehemently opposed the proposed 1.75% tax on electronic transactions, popularly known as e-levy, contained in the 2022 budget. If passed, the law would include taxes on mobile money payment, which is used by 40% of Ghanaians 15 years and older, according to a 2021 data by the Central Bank. Up against a deadline, the government wanted the bill passed under a certificate of urgency on the last day of sitting, but a brawl broke out on the floor when the first deputy speaker, Joseph Osewusu, pushed for the vote. The regular speaker was absent from the session. Opposition MP Mahama Ayariga says the deputy was circumventing normal procedure in an attempt to force the bill through parliament.
The House is governed by rules. And so when we try to undermine those rules, what do you expect the MPs to do? They won't just sit aside and watch the person undermine them.
The acting speaker, Osewusu, says he operated within the standing orders of Ghana's parliament and had a right to vote for the bill under consideration.
As long as we can change over, then that advantage is restored. And in my view, and I still hold that view very strongly, that as long as we can change the seat at any time, this should not give us a disadvantage. Otherwise, no proceedings will go on. Why should I come and preside so that I can't take any decision? What is the point?
About 50 lawmakers took part in the brawl. Only one was injured, the Minister of Youth and Sports, who got a cut in the face. The executive director of the African Center for Parliamentary Affairs, ESEPA, Rashid Draman, told a local radio station that Ghana should brace for more gridlock in the current parliament.
I have never seen anything like this. And for me, I've said this since the beginning of the year, that if we are not careful, this is how the if parliament is going to be. If parliament is going to be characterized by a lot of confusion, a lot of gridlock.
Parliament has now been adjourned until January 18 to give lawmakers more room to consult on the controversial electronic levy. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 22nd. Officials in Madagascar say rescue operations were continuing late Tuesday for survivors and victims of a boat accident that took place on Monday off the country's coast. It had been carrying about 130 passengers. The Madagascar embassy in Washington, D.C. told VOA on Tuesday that 45 people had been rescued and 36 bodies recovered. The officials declined our request for a voice interview, saying the embassy was not authorized to answer questions for broadcast. It had been reported that the boat was registered as a cargo ship and was not authorized to transport people. It was also said to be overloaded. A helicopter carrying the commander of the Madagascar Gendarmerie and two other senior officers crashed while en route to investigate the boat accident. The embassy said the Gendarmerie leader and another officer were found alive and well and receiving medical treatment in the capital, Antananarivo. It says the pilot of the helicopter was still missing as of Tuesday evening. The embassy says the prime minister and the minister of defense of Madagascar were on board another helicopter, which it says arrived safely at its destination. A former presidential candidate in the Democratic Republic of Congo says many Congolese do not believe President Felix Tshisekedi's announcement that the presence of Ugandan troops in the DRC is only temporary to fight against the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, rebels. Noel Shiani, leader of the Forces of Change political grouping, says if that were true, then Congolese forces should also be allowed to enter Uganda because the ADF is known to have operated in both the DRC and Uganda. He says if only Ugandan troops are allowed to cross into the DRC, many fear it will amount to the balkanization of eastern Congo, where the DRC government may lose its authority over the region in favor of Ugandan and Rwandan forces. This comes as Lit reports say several people were killed during Monday's protests by residents of Goma City over the alleged presence of Rwandan police in the city. Shiani says while the presence of Rwandan police is only a rumor, Ugandan and Rwandan forces once fought each other in the DRC, and the citizens of eastern Congo are fearful of a deja vu.
James, indeed, thousands of people from Goma protesting on the street, they were reacting to the rumor that Rwandan policemen have entered the town of Goma, and the population is not happy about it. They say that there is no need for them to come to our country because we have our own police. But again, that is based on the rumor.
So where do you think the information is coming from?
I believe that they have been just a speculation based on the fact that the government has acknowledged that the Ugandan troops have entered the Congo. Since in the past, the Rwandese and the Ugandan have both entered the Congo, I believe that people have just assumed that since Uganda is in the Congo, Rwanda must bring in also the policemen from its side. And the fear is that in the past, Ugandan troops have fought with the Rwandese troops in Kisangani. So if both armies from these neighboring countries enter the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the fear is that they might again go beyond just helping the Congolese police and fight among themselves, which could end up causing a lot of casualties to the Congolese side.
What is the general reaction in the DRC to the arrival of the Ugandan troops?
About the Ugandan troops, the reaction is the same. Many Congolese do not want foreign armies to enter our country, particularly foreign armies coming from the countries which in the past have occupied the eastern Congo without permission from the Congolese people. And those people, Ugandan and Rwandese, they are viewed as invaders. That's why some residents of Goma have said that even Mobutu has not betrayed the country by selling a portion of the country to any foreign country.
President Felix Tshisekedi has said that the presence of the Ugandan troops in the DRC is only temporary to fight against the ADF, or the Allied Democratic Forces rebel group. Your comment?
Yes, indeed. That's what the government has claimed. The problem is that many people don't believe that that is going to be so short-lived. that these foreign armies are just going to do the job as planned by the government of the DRC and leave peacefully, return back to their country. And as a matter of fact, personally, I have suggested that if the idea is to fight the ADF, since the ADF have been operating both in the DRC and in Uganda, I have recommended that the agreement signed by the government of the DRC and the government of Uganda, that agreement should allow both armies to move freely within the area which is covered by the ADF, which means that the army of Uganda and the army of the Democratic Republic of the Congo should operate in the Congo to go after the ADF wherever they are. But if it is discovered that the ADF do also operate in Uganda, the two armies, meaning the army of Uganda and the army of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, should also, both of them, be allowed to enter freely the Ugandan territory to go after the ADF. But if it is only the Ugandan troops which are allowed to enter the DRC and the DRC troops cannot enter Uganda, I think that many people will continue to be very suspicious about the real intention of what is being done, which could end up into what is feared here as the Balkanization of Eastern Congo, where the Democratic Republic of the Congo would lose some of its authority on a portion of the territory in favor of Uganda or in favor of Rwanda.
Noel Shiani is the leader of the Forces of Change political group in the DRC and a former presidential candidate. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. In Zimbabwe, the government board established to fight corruption says the effort is hampered by the lack of protection for whistleblowers. Others say the body lacks the funds and other resources to deal with the problem. Rutendo Manwere reports from Harare.
Justice Lois Matanda Moyo is the chair of the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission, or ZAC. She says many people who witness corruption, including waste, fraud and mismanagement, will not step forward without a guarantee that they are safe reprisals by the government.
Our legal regime has a great lacuna in terms of the existence of a whistleblower and witness protection framework. This has a negative effect of retarding potential whistleblowers from whistleblowing due to fear of victimization. Therefore, corrupt people are left scot-free due to lack of evidence incriminating them to acts of corruption.
Matanda Moyo is calling on the government to speed up the establishment of a framework to protect whistleblowers. She also says the COVID-19 pandemic has created unprecedented corruption. They include companies that are inflating prices for personal protective equipment, ventilators, medication, and even falsified medicines, compromising the safety of patients.
In addition, it created vast opportunities for corruption to thrive due to the relaxation of safeguards under emergency protocols and weakened oversight mechanisms created as a response to COVID-19.
Atanda Moyo says the poor ranking of Zimbabwe and the Transparency International's yearly assessments of global corruption taints the country's ability to attract investments.
The impact of the Corruption Perception Index on investment can never be overemphasized, since it has a negative effect of repelling investments at a time when it is most needed.
The latest Transparency International figures rank Zimbabwe in the 157th position out of all countries dealing with public sector corruption. 108 is the worst ranking possible. Joining Zimbabwe, the bottom of the list are Somalia, South Sudan, Guinea-Bissau, and Equatorial Guinea. The most transparent governments in Africa include Seychelles, Botswana, Cabo Verde, Rwanda, Namibia, and Mauritius. Obani Chavango is the program's coordinator for Transparency International Zimbabwe, or TIZ.
Take this opportunity to reiterate our call for the government to speed up this legislation, as this is one of the missing links in the fight against corruption in Zimbabwe.
Chabangu adds that institutions that fight corruption need to be strengthened and receive the necessary resources to fight the problem.
TIZ strongly underlines the importance of strong institutions which are well-resourced and committed in responding to corruption and other related vices. There is a need to have set out budgetary commitments that support anti-corruption institutions.
Chabangu also says that the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission needs to successfully take cases to court and have criminals brought to book to increase the public trust in good governance institutions. However, commission officials say out of more than 1,000 cases brought into their attention, only 184 were sent to court for prosecution and only 12 convictions were attained. Transparency International's rankings are reflected in another report this year by a private anti-corruption group called The Sentry. Its study, called Shadows and Shell Games, Uncovering an Offshore Business Empire in Zimbabwe, reveals key details of the business practices of leading government officials, including businessmen and presidential advisor Kudakwashe Tagwire. He and others named in the report denied the charges. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
The Confederation of African Football's president says the African Football Cup of Nations AFCON tournament will take place as scheduled in Cameroon beginning next month. However, construction workers at the stadium hosting the opening and final matches say they doubt the stadium will be ready. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
The Africa Football Cup of Nations tournament is scheduled to begin January 9 at Olembe Stadium in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. On Monday, Confederation of African Football President Patrice Motsepe visited the 60,000-seat stadium, which is still under construction, less than 3 weeks before the opening match. Motsepe says construction workers are improving on the stadium, and he is optimistic Cameroon will be ready for the opener.
There's a huge commitment and a focus to make sure that some of those issues that are being put in place in the next few days, good progress is being made. My message is to Africa and to the world, the people of Cameroon are ready to show the world the best of African football, but also the best of African hospitality. It's going to be a successful AFCON. So come January 9, they must kick off.
Motsepe's visit came amid persistent local media reports that Olembe Stadium would not be ready. Bulldozers dug and arranged roads at the stadium entrance on Tuesday, a day after Motsepe's visit. Several dozen young people transported and planted trees, flowers, and grass that officials say will beautify the facility. Among the workers is 35-year-old building construction engineer Luke Elundu. Elundu says he is not sure the entire parking lot of the stadium will be complete within a week, as requested by the government of Cameroon.
Last month, we are about 1,000 people here, but now I'm seeing not up to 300. Workers are not coming. Why? They work without money. It's important money to come and work, but they don't have their salary. The work is much, even more than a year, we don't be able to finish the work.
Jean Fadrick is technical director of the stadium. He says 2,000 workers have been recruited to make sure that before a joint CAF FIFA control mission visits, the stadium is ready for the opening match.
On est en train de finir de mettre en place les derniers matériaux, une forte mobilisation.
Fadrick says workers are arranging parking spaces for cars that will bring football fans, players and match officials to the stadium. He says a huge mobilization of over 2,000 workers and several hundred compactors and construction equipment within the past 2 months is indicative that Cameroon is bent on finalizing construction work within 1 week. Stadium construction began in March 2017. The government said the facility would be ready for the 2020 AFCON. But in January 2020, the CAF postponed the tournament for a year, saying Cameroon was not ready. The CAF moved the tournament again in January 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm Jen.